Thank you, Dina. With that, I'd like to welcome questions and answers. As I said, state your name and organization before asking your question. And for those of you online, the 90 of you online participating from around the globe, please, again, state your name, organization, and actually where you're participating from before asking your question so that we can recognize you as well. And with that, I'll open it up.
I'm Dan Norell from World Vision, and this is a question for Patrick. And just in terms of your model that you have across Africa and then your change to Ethiopia, why the change? What was the factors that you had a very different model in Ethiopia?
Well, one of the things that Ethiopia is replicate the common branding and package of training and facility design that we had done through the Farm Service Center models in Afghanistan, Georgia, Romania, Moldova. And the main reason for doing that, or the value proposition in developing what will essentially be a franchise network, is to establish a recognizable brand for smallholders where they know that they can get quality products, never counterfeit, never improperly repackaged, service with the sale from qualified professionals. They will be larger businesses that we expect to be able to get volume discounts on their own inventories and offer an improved product along with along with service at a competitive price with existing sources of inputs. And we think it'll be a model for replication, not just in Ethiopia, but in other countries around the world.
We have a question from online.
We've had several folks online wanting to learn more about credit guarantees. And Alex Snellgrove from Aperio Toronto asks, he wants to know more about how the credit guarantees have worked, how effective they are, how many dealers were able to access credit, and after the guarantee was removed, how many dealers were able to continue to access credit.
All right, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to give you hard numbers for all of those, but I can explain in general how the credit guarantee worked. Usually these funds were small, $300,000, $400,000, placed on deposit with a commercial bank. From country to country, it differed as to whether they were targeting commercial lenders. In many cases, commercial lenders, or the size of an agri-dealer is below the threshold for a minimum loan for a commercial lender. So in many cases, they were microfinance institutions. I would say most commonly, it was a trade credit guarantee from wholesale suppliers. One of the rules that we built into all of these guarantee programs is that agri-dealers would not be able to access it more than one or two seasons. So they, in response to the question of how did they do after the guarantee facility was removed, they only got to access it once or twice over the life of a four-year program. And from what we've seen, they did continue to access trade credit. That's part of the reason for the high leverage ratio, the 6-to-1 leverage ratio that we talked about, because those are agri-dealers that are continuing to get trade credit without the guarantee. That $1 that we use for the guarantee the first or second time they used it is continuing to generate trade credit long after they're no longer using the credit guarantee facility. The numbers of agri-dealers, I think virtually all of the 7,000 that we supported at some time or another did access the credit guarantee facility. As I said, for the Africa agri-dealer programs, it was the key in getting these businesses off the ground. And the repayment rate has been very good. In most countries, well higher than 90%. So.
I'm Jean Downing from USAID. I was wondering what happened to the existing private sector? I mean, to what extent, to what extent is this crowding out the existing private sector? What has been the impact on private providers, private service providers, input suppliers who are already there? And I guess also, coming from the enterprise development community, we had the Donor Committee for Enterprise Development. We focused for years on business development centers. And I think one of the issues that we all the donors, came to was that overheads tended to be high. Once the subsidies were withdrawn, the sustainability was really questioned. And I don't know the context of Moldova, whether there was no private sector. Just the concerns about the sustainability and your impact on the private sector with the subsidies that you are investing.
Sure, that's a fair question. And in the first place, I suppose we have to recognize that the matching investment grants are subsidies. But the point that I'd like to make about the grants methodology is that what we're doing really is buying down risk for local private entrepreneurs to invest in their own economies. And with the matching requirement, a one-to-one match, so for every dollar of USAID funds invested in those, private entrepreneurs having to come up with a dollar of their own, most commonly what we're doing is facilitating the engagement of the commercial finance sector in rural agribusinesses in a way that they would not otherwise have considered without the presence of a hand-holding from a development organization and the relative security of this matching investment of USAID funds. Obviously, the Moldova experience and now the Georgia experience and Afghanistan experience prove that they're profitable businesses, and that's the lesson that we've been trying to get out there. Farmers are risk-averse. The agribusiness community tends to be risk-averse as well. So one of the most important reasons for investing grant funds in programs like this is to show, not just in the early stages, but over time, that it is profitable to do retail business with smallholders in the long run. So we're not trying to solve the input supply programs of any of these countries by investing matching grant funds. We're trying to establish models that will demonstrate to other entrepreneurs that they too can do this business without the subsidy. An impact on the existing private sector, it certainly is the case that with the Farm Service Center model, we were filling a hole that was otherwise unserved. In the collapse of the collective farm system, the emergence of smallholder farmers, privatization of land, all the systems that used to supply farm inputs and services had collapsed. And smallholder farmers were largely at the mercy of the larger farmers that had somehow emerged from the privatization process that still had their links to the big suppliers in the major cities, and smallholders essentially getting their cast-offs, their rejects, their machinery after their field works had already been done. So we weren't really displacing anybody with those programs. I think it's a different discussion with the agro-dealer training in Africa because there are many agro-dealers out there operating at various levels of sophistication, usually very simple operations. To that, I would say what we're doing is raising the bar. An African smallholder deserves to know what product he's buying. He deserves to have some professional consultation with his purchase. He deserves to know that if he comes today and buys a product and he comes back tomorrow and it's faulty or he has a question or he wants follow-up, he's going to find the same person, the same vendor there qualified to respond to his questions. So I think it's inevitable that as we build the professionalism of some agro-dealers, we catalyze a process by which some sort of evolution takes place and some of the less professional agro-dealers drop out. Most of them raise their bar of service to compete, and we think that's a good thing.
Just reaffirm what Patrick's saying from a 30,000 foot perspective and more from the multinationals. It's vital in a sense to have a public private partnership for us to enter into the market in some ways. And we've actually, through CropLife Foundation, have partnered with CFA to do some experimental plots, and it's basically been to show the farmers the value, increased yields, productivity, and the rest. So we've done that. We've also expended a lot of money as charitable contributions to do train-the-trainer programs to show that, you know, safe use is a very effective way to increase your yields and the rest. So we haven't seen that as blocking out private enterprise. It's just the opposite. It's opening the door for us.
Ms. Capisa is still on the line. Do you have any comments on the question about displacement of other agro-dealers?
You mean the placement? Can you come again?
Jean, would you care to repeat the question for me?
What I was asking about was what has been the impact of these investments on the existing private sector actors?
The impact has been very good. In fact, the thing is, the big supply companies usually stay very far from where the small peasant farmers are. So the agro dealers, in terms of business, they are doing very well. Most of them have got good big businesses. They have been linked to supply companies, and they are able now to support the small scale farmer in the rural area. So the impact, of course, has been great in the sense that they have been very instrumental in the distribution of high quality seeds, the small agro dealers, in the implementation as well, in the distribution of protection products, and have been also able to give them information. And as somebody has already said, that once they found that the product is of substandard, they will always come back, and the agro dealer is always there to assist them, find out what is wrong with the product. So the impact is very good, because the good example is what I'm giving you. I started with one shop. Now I am talking of four shops, and I am employing more than 15 people, and at least something is happening somewhere, and more farmers, I'm helping about 3,000 farmers around my shop. So what about the 2,000 agro dealers who are trained and they are in business? If we can say 2,000 people are being assisted, at least there is an impact somewhere.
Okay. We have a question from online.
I think I've answered your question.
This question is from Dilip Bhandari from Heifer International in Little Rock, Arkansas, and who asks, how are the agri-dealers making sure that they are selling quality inputs that are not counterfeit or outdated? Basically, how are these inputs sourced by agro-dealers?
That's a very good point, and that's a key part of the training that we provide to agri-dealers, how to recognize a quality product, the importance of, a lot of times what you see in terms of poor quality products at agri-dealers is not only counterfeit, but somebody buying a large bag of seed or a large bag of fertilizer and then spooning it out into smaller bags in the packaging that smallholders really need for their small plots. That process of opening containers and repackaging them in inappropriate containers is both environmentally dangerous, dangerous to human health, and opens the opportunity to dilute them, adulterate them, and reduce the quality. So it's one of the strictest elements of our training and our certification process for agri-dealers that kind of activity not be allowed to take place. We also help agri-dealers through their agri-dealer associations to work with wholesale suppliers in their countries to advocate for the availability of more and more small packaged products, whether it's plant protection products, small packs of seed, or 1, 5, 10 kilogram packages of fertilizer, so that they have the inventory on hand that farmers are needing, that are demanding, and there's no need to do improper repackaging. Now, in counterfeit inputs per se, that is one of the most challenging issues, because in many cases a well-intentioned agri-dealer has little control over the product that's being provided from his wholesale supplier, and not enough knowledge to be able to recognize, even from very well-done labels, if it's really Roundup or if it's a knockoff. It's an element of our training, and particularly in the credit guarantee facility, as we're directly forming the linkages between agri-dealers and the wholesale suppliers, we make every effort to make sure the wholesale suppliers we're working with are the official distributors for the major input manufacturers.
And we have there's a whole slew of new programs that are being designed to try to increase this surety that you've got the right product. In particular, there's hollow spots now being put on some of the major manufacturers' products with identifiable barcodes and telephone numbers that the dealer or the recipient or the farmer itself is supposed to call back to check to make sure that is a legitimate, you know, product. But as Patrick said, the label copying of labels is a major business, and they're very effective because if Bayer, Syngenta, somebody puts out a new label, within 2 hours the copy, you know, the counterfeiters can duplicate that label. So the hollow spots, the telephone numbers, there's a whole slew of other devices that are being tried in pilots as a way to hopefully guarantee you've got the right product, and to train the farmer or the dealer himself as to how to handle that call, etc.
Good morning. I'm Giselle Aris from Lando Lakes. My questions are for Patrick and for Dina. I'm wondering, in the different regions and countries you've worked in, when you work with all these agro dealers, can you give us a rough percentage breakdown of men versus women dealers that you're working with? And for both Dina and Patrick, if you've noticed there are any constraints to women entering these private sector positions, could you tell us what they are and the strategies you use to help mitigate them?
I think it'd be suitable if we let Dina answer that one first.
Dina, did you hear the question?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, gender has to be looked into, but the problem is usually women are fewer than men. The problem is women do not have access to finance in most cases. And it's very difficult for one to start a business when you completely have nothing. But here in Malawi, we are trying to do that. There are so many women who are agro dealers, though the number is a bit fewer. I don't have the actual figures, but I think CNFA has got the figures. There are fewer women agro dealers, but more women access the farm inputs through the subsidy program, through the women agro dealers. So the good thing is these people know where to find certified seed because of the certified agro dealers. And what we are doing is here we have established an association for the agro dealers whereby we are trying to sensitize the majority of the people that this is not a man's world only. Women can also join in. So more women are joining in. I hope in the near future we'll have more women agro dealers and more women farmers are already there. I think I've answered part of that.
Yeah,
absolutely. I believe statistically about 30% of our agro dealers are women. Certainly we would like that to be higher, but as Dina points out, it is an issue of access to capital most commonly. Some of the approaches that we've employed in order to increase the number of women participating are to have, in the first place, female certified trainers who are out promoting the fee-based agro dealer training to their friends and peers and to other businesswomen in their communities. That's been one of the most effective approaches, I believe.
We have a question from online.
Vincent Potier from Syngenta in Switzerland and Gabriel Songole from City Hope in Malawi were both asking about the selection of agro dealers, how CNFA Agra selects them, what qualifications they need, and is it people with basic technical knowledge in farming or just people with good reputations within their community, and which category was most successful as agro dealers?
Sure. Well, I draw a big difference between the farm service center model, if you'll forgive me for parsing words, the grant-driven model that I referred to, during which the selection process was very thorough, very much an investment due diligence process, looking at their past business operations, their ability to make a matching investment, developing detailed business plans to look ahead at their future financial performance. That was a very rigorous selection process because we're investing significant amounts usually U.S. taxpayer money in getting those businesses off the ground. The agro dealer selection, by contrast, in Africa, which was really a training model, in those examples, anybody that could pay for the agro dealer training, that could pay the certified commercial trainers to receive the basic business management and technical training could do it. Anybody that was interested to pay could do it. And most of them, in fact, I would say the vast, vast majority of them, did not have any particular either business skills or agricultural knowledge before purchasing the training. And that agro-dealer training is designed to take essentially laymen and make them into small entrepreneurs and basic agribusiness consultants or agronomic consultants.
Do we have any other questions in the room?
Hi there. I'm Eric Fernhaber from the USAID Enabling Agricultural Trade Projects. And Ms. Capizza mentioned briefly the concept of the enabling environment. And I was kind of curious of, as far as how that plays into developing these private sector supply systems.
Again, maybe Mrs. Capizza will have a lot to say about the Malawi example. I'll tee her up with one of the issues that I think is most important in enabling environment for retail input supply. Very commonly in the countries in which we work, governments run large-scale input subsidy programs. Most commonly it's fertilizer, but often it extends to seed as well. Usually that amounts to a government truck pulling up into the village on a given day and offloading bags of fertilizer and passing them out for free to everybody in the community. No extension training is provided. There's no effort to match up the fertilizer with the needs of the soil in that community. It's often an inefficient, costly for the government, and not very useful for the farmer giveaway that completely shuts out the private sector. So I'll give one example of where I think our advocacy efforts have been most effective, which is Tanzania, where through the Tanzania Agri-Dealer Association, they were actually able to get themselves included in the Tanzanian government's input subsidy program, which was converted to a voucher-based program, including electronic vouchers, where farmers had to go to CNFA-certified agro-dealers in order to redeem those vouchers. And one of the reasons for doing that is that in redeeming the vouchers at the agro-dealers, the government of Tanzania knew that they could get service with the sale. They could get tailored advice on seed selection, because there were a range of seeds available, on fertilizer selection, again, a range of fertilizers available, and detailed instructions on how to go back and apply those in a way that would make the best use of the Tanzanian government's investment in inputs. It's a good partnership between the private sector retail distribution and the public sector subsidy program, which we too rarely see. And maybe Dina would like to say something about what advocacy has done for the enabling environment in Malawi. She certainly is at the forefront of it.
Yeah, here in Malawi, I say it's a very good enabling environment with the government, because we work hand in hand with the government. For example, as you have already put it, we have the subsidy program here in Malawi. Most of the small-scale farmers were able to access good seed from certified agro-dealers. And they were sensitized. We work hand in hand with the extension workers from the EPAs where we are. So the farmers really know where to get good quality seed, which is not fake, or where they can get fertilizers. It's because there is that enabling environment. So many people are able to access the fertilizers from us through that angle. And another thing is the government has given us freedom to form associations, which can lobby government if there are any other laws or any policies that we would like the government to help us. And our government is a listening government. We are able to contact them whenever we have anything. That's how we came in to join with the subsidy program, because previously we were not in the group of the subsidy, providing subsidies. But as soon as we talked to them, they were able to listen to us, and they included us on the program. And when they have their meetings, we usually come there and give them feedback on what is happening on the ground. So it's a good enabling environment.
Thank you. Do we have any questions online?
We have a quick question for Dina from Katie Turner, who says that you've spoken about credit for agro-dealers, but what about credit for small farmers? Is credit offered to the smallholders? And if so, who is it from you, Dina, or from the bank?
What we're trying to help farmers is we ask them to be in groups. We train them, and fortunately enough, here in Malawi, there are so many NGOs which are training them in village savings and other things. And so these people, when they are grouped together, they are able to access credit from finance companies. I have a certain group in my area of women. They came to me, they wanted to buy from my shop. on credit. Unfortunately, because I get the goods on credit from the supply companies, it was difficult for me to give them on credit too. So what I did, I organized them as a group and introduced them to the microloan finance company, where they were trained in business management, and then they were given the loan, and they came to buy from me. As a result, they bought the seed from me, and when they grew, they harvested their produce. I was able to buy from them. So that's the way we support these small-scale farmers. I wished if I could provide credit to them. Right now, I have tried on pilot basis where I have organized 15 women from BMP village. I have provided them with groundnut seed, and they will pay back 30 kilograms of groundnut seed. And the other seed, I asked them to give their friends so that next year there will be more women in the group. I started with 15. I want maybe next year to have 30, then, and the number should grow on like that. I'm just trying to empower those women.
This is Christo Planic, USAID. Patrick, I was curious, in the Moldova example, I think it's great you guys went back years later to see how many were still standing, and we need to do more of that. But I'm curious, the ones that had closed, was there any further research evaluation on what happened to them? Did it tend to be more men or women? Was it that they couldn't get credit? What was it, just oversupply in the market? Did you have any information on that?
Sure. Not exactly statistically reliable. I'd say it's more anecdotal. But if I had to mention some general causes, the most common would be what you might say was oversaturation. I think we're replacing them in markets that were too small and too isolated. So, if the village is 5,000 people, it's far from any kind of market center. It's particularly if it's growing field crops, because one thing that I haven't mentioned in the presentation is that because they serve smallholders, the best customers are smallholders that grow high-value crops. If you have a community of smallholders in a relatively cold climate, which is common in Moldova, who are growing field crops, which are low-investment, low-return crops, it does not make for a viable local retail supply, input supply business. So a little bit oversaturation, some lessons learned about which crops, what kind of producers to be targeting. It's still very hard to get a rural agricultural loan in Moldova, so an undercapitalized enterprise was another common cause. And also what everyone knew would happen as a result of the privatization process in these post-Soviet countries, the gradual emergence of the large farmer who, as he grows in size and financial capability, less and less needs a local retail input supplier.
Hi, Alan Schroeder, consultant. What do the pesticide registration systems look like in these countries, and how do you link with Global Gap?
I've heard your name many times. Nice to finally meet you, Alan Schroeder. In Moldova, it was actually very strict, continuing that example. They had kept largely the Soviet system for pesticide and seed registration on the books. Very difficult for major international companies to introduce a new product. Many of the products that were registered were Category 2 products and really not allowed by USAID funding. We went by USAID regulations in those cases, and we allowed the stores to stock, as would be established through a purse swap, stock only the products that meet the EPA regulations. So that resulted in maybe 60% of the list of approved agrochemicals in Moldova being allowed in farm service center inventories. Georgia was an entirely different case, much more liberal. They'd thrown everything out the book, and they were entirely willing to go with USAID regulations. And the products were available. To their credit, the major international companies were very engaged in Georgia, delivering modern products that meet modern environmental standards. Afghanistan's a different case. Complete chaos and a large dependence on inventory that comes from Pakistan and from China. Very difficult to regulate. And mostly dealing with generics of older products that are still allowed for sale in the United States, not so much with the brand name products that we'd like to see. In Africa, because of the relatively low penetration of modern plant protection products, we usually have a clean slate, and we're able to start from scratch, particularly in the countries of East Africa, like Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania. It's a relatively modern and favorable environmental regulatory environment. I would say the bigger problem than the product selection are the worker safety possibilities, the availability of running water in every location, proper ventilation. Anybody that's ever visited agri-dealers in Africa, there's a common sensation of an overpowering smell of agrochemicals that's not healthy either for workers or for customers. So getting the facilities right so that you're able to ventilate them properly for the safety of workers and clients. Protective gear, gloves, masks, coveralls for workers, it's just not practiced. And even those that are out spraying in the field, you commonly see people without respirators, without gloves. So I think in environmental safety, it's those that are the bigger challenges than the selection of products on the shelf. And global gap. Well, global gap remains an illusory dream for most smallholder farmers, and the key issue being the inability of exporters to conduct the traceability all the way down to the level of a 1-hectare farm. Unfortunately, I would say the trend that we see more commonly and that we hope to be able to change in years is a vertical integration whereby the traders begin to secure their own raw material base where they can vouch for the production practices that have been used and the post-harvest handling and the packaging and the transport all the way through to the end user, completely bypassing the smallholder farmer. The most effective interventions I've seen on that front are where farmers are able to organize farmer groups that can conduct bulk input supply, that can agree and enforce on production practices, and which can share post-harvest infrastructure in order to be able to maintain produce quality and traceability after harvest.
Okay, with that, I'd like to thank our speakers for joining us today. Thanks to Doug Nelson, Patrick Norrell, and a special thanks to Dina Kapiza for joining us from all the way from Malawi today to give her insights as an agro dealer there. All right, thank you.
Thank you.